hospital from mines and booby traps sown by enemy guerrillas and sympathetic peasants, including women, even children. None of which excuses what happened that March 16th. A platoon headed by First Lieutenant William Calley herded hundreds of old men, women, children, even babies from the hamlet of Milai into a ditch and shot them. A court-martial found Calley guilty of premeditated murder and sentenced him to life in prison. President Richard Nixon intervened, and Calley's sentence was reduced to 3 years. Captain Ernest Medina was also tried, but was acquitted. The Milai massacre was an appalling example of much that had gone wrong in Vietnam. Because the war had dragged on for so long, not everyone commissioned was really officer material. In order to fight the war without calling up the reserves, the Army was creating instant non-coms. It astonished me how well and heroically some of these green kids performed, assuming responsibility far beyond their years and experience. Still, so many unprepared officers and non-coms led to breakdowns in morale, discipline, and professional judgment, and to horrors like My Lai, as the troops became numb to what appeared to be endless and mindless slaughter. My tour was to end in July of 1969. Judged solely in professional terms, it was a success. I received the Legion of Merit, and General Geddes awarded me the Soldier's Medal for my role in the helicopter crash rescue. The Legion of Merit I received? It might have meant more to me in a war where medals were not distributed so indiscriminately. You accepted them because everyone else did. But as time passed and my perspective enlarged, I began examining the experience more penetratingly. The pernicious game-playing that I had first detected in Gelnhausen had flowered into readiness and training reports that were routinely inflated to please and conceal, rather than to evaluate and correct. We were also deluded by technology. The enemy was primitive, and we were the most technologically advanced nation on Earth. Dark episodes like My Lai resulted in part because of the military's obsession with another semi-fiction, the body count. The press knew exactly the casualties on our side. They simply counted the caskets going out. How many of the enemy fell? Finding out was not so easy. They did not use caskets. Every night the company would make a tally. How many did your platoon get? I don't know. We saw two for sure. Well, if you saw two, there were probably eight. So let's say 10. Counting bodies became a macabre statistical competition. Another officer who served in that division was a lieutenant colonel named H. Norman Schwarzkopf. Norm Schwarzkopf, I, and so many others who went on to major military responsibility carried away something useful from the experience. You do not squander courage and lives without clear purpose, without the country's backing, and without full commitment. We vowed that when our turn came to call the shots, we would not quietly acquiesce in half-hearted warfare for half-baked reasons that the American people could not understand or support. If we could make good on that promise to ourselves and to the country, then the sacrifices of Vietnam would not have been in vain. With a few weeks left in my tour, I received a letter from George Washington University. I had been accepted for the fall class in the School of Government and Business Administration. On my return to the States, Alma and I had planned to spend a few days by ourselves before joining the kids and my in-laws in Birmingham. We arranged to stay in a hotel in Atlanta. That night I fell asleep unfashionably early. Try as she might, Alma could not keep me awake. She kept tugging at me, saying I had to watch television because the astronauts were walking on the moon. It was July 20th, 1969. Early in July of the next year, I opened the Army Times and there it was. I would be promoted to lieutenant colonel the next month. I thought there ought to be some ceremonial fuss. I solved the problem by assembling the troops in the family room. Alma was out, and I was babysitting. I sat on the floor amid a jumble of toys while Michael Powell, now age 7, pinned a silver leaf on my sports shirt. The witnesses were Linda, 5, and our most recent arrival, Anne Marie Powell, watching with minimal interest from her infant seat. I reported with my MBA to the Pentagon in July of 1971, assigned to AVICE, the Office of the Assistant Vice Chief of Staff of the Army. The holder of that position was Lieutenant General William E. Depew. I was assigned a cubicle and after a time began working with General Depew himself. One day early in 1972, I was invited to attend a hush-hush meeting in the General's office. Depew quickly got to the point. The Army's pullout from Vietnam was accelerating. The failure of the war had soured the country on the military. Depew said, "Powell, I want you to take a couple of bright guys, go off into a corner, and start thinking the unthinkable. I want you to figure out how we would structure a 500,000-man army." Inevitably, our work leaked to senior officers. Terror struck the Pentagon. The 500,000-man base army proposal was shelved and never saw the light of day. Still, no experience is ever a total loss. When I faced a similar reality as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, I had already completed my graduate education in force cutting 20 years earlier under Bill Depew. There may be one moment in our lives we can look back on later and say that, for good or evil, it was the turning point. For me, that day came in November of 1971, while I was still in General Depew's office. A major in the infantry branch called to tell me that he was sending over an application for me to fill out for a White House fellowship. The major made clear that infantry branch was not asking me, it was ordering me. The goal of the White House Fellows Program was to give future American leaders a better appreciation of how public policy was shaped and how their government operated. When I was selected, I knew where I wanted to spend my year as a White House Fellow, the Office of Management and Budget. I knew from my MBA courses and my time in the Pentagon that budgets are to organizations what blood is to the circulatory system. At OMB, I was interviewed by a small, wiry, engaging dynamo named Frank Carlucci, the deputy to the director, Caspar Weinberger. Not long after my arrival, Weinberger left OMB to head the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. I had only brief exposure to these men at the time, but they were going to change my life. In the game of musical chairs that followed, Fred Malik became deputy director of OMB. I was soon installed as his special assistant. As the White House Fellows year wound to a close, Fred Malik called me into his office. His television set was tuned to Senator Sam Ervin's Watergate Investigating Subcommittee. "This'll blow over," Fred observed. He wanted to talk to me about staying on at OMB for another year. I knew by now that my initial reluctance to become a White House Fellow was the era of a greenhorn. When the fellows discussed the power of the executive branch, it was with President Nixon. When we studied the legislative branch, it was with U.S. senators. The aim of the program was to let us inside the engine room to see the cogs and gears of government grinding away, and also to take us up high for the panoramic view. Still, I was ready to return to the Army. As a grad student, a Pentagon desk officer, and a White House Fellow, I had been away from real soldiering for over 3 years. The Army was my life. I wound up slated for Korea with command of the 1st Battalion, 32nd Infantry, 2nd Infantry Division, 8th Army. The hard part was telling Alma where I was going. Korea was an unaccompanied tour, which meant leaving her alone for a year with three children, ages 10, 8, and 3. My wife, a sensible woman, was not thrilled. "But if this is what you want," she said, "if this is what you think is best for you, then do it." Her support made it easier, but not easy. My new commanding general, Major General Henry E. Gunfighter Emerson, had taken over the 2nd Division at Camp Casey just a few months before I arrived in Korea. As we dragged ourselves home from Vietnam, the nation turned its back on the military. Many of our troops were life's dropouts. General Emerson was determined to turn around this slack, demoralized operation. He gave the job his total attention. He had begun a program for remaking the 2nd Infantry Division, which he called pro-life, not to be confused with the anti-abortion movement. Emerson's pro-life program, as he put it, was to provide the soldier opportunities to become a winner rather than a loser in life. Camp Casey was about an hour's drive from Seoul. The atmosphere was pure war zone with none of the softening amenities of a post where families live. We were there to obstruct a North Korean attack. If and when that danger ever lifted, the Army would pull out. "Good morning, Camp Casey!" The determinedly cheery radio voice woke me every day at 5:30 a.m. Another of Gunfighter Emerson's pro-life antidotes to brawling, drug abuse, boozing, and lechery was physical exhaustion. Consequently, we began the day with a 4-mile run, to be completed in 32 minutes or less. One winter day, Gunfighter summoned the brigade officers to tell us we were going into something called reverse cycle training. We were to turn night into day. "After all," Gunfighter pointed out, "the North Koreans won't be fighting us 9 to 5. We did this for 10-day stretches, trying to turn the circadian clock around, which for certain constitutions never worked. The meals at these ungodly hours literally made some soldiers sick, but Gunfighter was right. Wars assume irregular hours. It was a cold April night, about 1 a.m. My battalion had been marching for hours. We had been in reverse cycle for a week. Finally, we had reached our destination. The exercise was over, and the exhausted, out-of-sync soldiers slumped to the ground, waiting to be trucked back to Camp Casey. One of my officers approached with a message that the division lacked enough gas to transport the battalion back to camp. We would have to march 30 kilometers. The men wearily dragged themselves to their feet and started, too exhausted to even complain. We were passing through a Korean village where the only sound was a dog howling in the night. My S3, Captain Harry W. Skipmore, dropped back from the head of the column to talk to me. "Sir," Moore said with an excitement out of keeping with the weary mood, "we've got just a little more than 12 miles to go. If we kick the battalion into high speed, we can finish it in less than 3 hours and use this march to qualify for the EIB. I had put the battalion through a punishing series of tests over the past 3 weeks. I was trying to qualify as many men as possible for the EIB, the Expert Infantryman's Badge, which is ordinarily earned by fewer than one infantryman out of five. The only remaining hurdle was the completion of the 12-mile hike in less than 3 hours. I looked back over the ragged column and said, "Skip, you got to be kidding." Moore kept at it. "Sir, it's flat terrain until the last couple of miles. I know these men. They can do it." One thing I had learned in the Army, you don't step on enthusiasm. The word went up and down the column to pick up the pace. The men fell into the rhythm like a train slowly picking up speed. We faced one final steep mountain leading into Camp Casey. I did not see how the men could make it. I myself had to stop every couple of hundred yards to take in gulps of air. And then, up ahead, I heard a few isolated voices counting cadence and Jody chant, and then a few more, until the mountains rang with the battalion singing. As we crossed the gate into camp, the sergeant started whipping this herd into precision ranks. As we hit the paved road and passed division headquarters and parade ground order, our raised voices woke up General Emerson. Gunfighter came out of his quarters in his bathrobe, beaming as the men passed in review. For me, this moment, in the middle of the Korean night, with 700 once-bedraggled soldiers now welded into a spirited whole, was magical, one of the treasured memories of my life. Officers of the rank of major and above got no medals under General Emerson. His explanation was characteristically blunt. "I don't believe in medals for officers. If you perform well, you'll get an outstanding efficiency report, and that's all you need." Junior officers still got medals, NCOs too, and medals were showered on the enlisted men. In Emerson's view, these were the kids who didn't quarterback the high school football team, didn't date the cheerleaders, didn't get elected to the student council, had never received enough recognition in their lives. He was finally going to make them winners at something. Promotion boards were still going to take decorations into account for people who had served elsewhere, under other commanders than Gunfighter Emerson. But having observed the abuses in Vietnam, and believing that reform has to start somewhere, I supported Gunfighter's guts and wisdom. My tour was winding down. I knew better than to expect any elaborate fanfare on turning over my command to my successor. No medals, no speeches. Gunfighter was as good as his word, however. He skipped the fireworks, but he gave me an excellent efficiency report, including a conclusion that I was general officer material. Just before I left Korea, I had bundled up all the letters Alma sent me. One of them I had read at the time with no particular reaction, but I have reread it since with a sense of wonder. On August 13, 1974, Alma wrote, "I feel we are on the verge of something exciting. I don't know what is in store for us, but something big and exciting will happen." What pleased me about attending my next career stop, the National War College, as much as the career significance, was that I did not have to uproot my family. In February 1976, midway through the one-year War College course, I received an accelerated promotion to full colonel. Many thoroughly respectable military careers top out at that grade, and I wondered how much further mine would go. After the War College, I was to take command of the 2nd Brigade of the 101st Airborne Division at Fort Campbell, Kentucky. I was the youngest in my War College class to make colonel, and one of only two Army officers in the class chosen for brigade command. I was excited to be joining the Screaming Eagles, a storybook outfit. When Bastogne was surrounded during the Battle of the Bulge, it was the 101st Commander, Brigadier General Anthony McAuliffe, who issued the legendary reply when the Germans demanded surrender. Nuts. The division's commander, Major General John Wickham, was the kind of officer whom gruffer types liked to denigrate as a political general because he had served in the Pentagon as a military assistant to two civilian secretaries of defense. The 101st had a unique mission, helicopter-borne assault, and General Wickham was its apostle. My folks came to Fort Campbell to celebrate Thanksgiving in 1976. Mom enjoyed catching up on her grandchildren and helping Alma in the kitchen. But Pop had come to Fort Campbell to see and be seen. I took him to an M-16 rifle range so that he could see what his son did for a living. We had drinks at the officers' club. We went to the division boxing matches with General Wickham. Luther sat in the front row as if he had never sat anywhere else, and he chatted with Wickham as if he had known generals all his life. On his last night with us, Pop sidled up to Alma in the kitchen and whispered, "Colin's going to be a general." Alma asked how he knew. He had been talking, Pop said, to General Wickham. Although I served most publicly during the Reagan-Bush years, I actually cut my teeth on national security during 2.5 years in the office of the Secretary of Defense during the Carter administration. In May 1977, I went to see someone named John Kester who had a title a mile long, Special Assistant to the Secretary and the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Kester's huge office was in the E-ring, the Eisenhower corridor of the Pentagon, and right next to the Secretary of Defense's office. Kester had created a 4-person team of military officers to help him, and he wanted me to run this unit as his executive assistant. The family returned from Fort Campbell to the Washington area, and we contracted to have a home built in Burke Center in Virginia's suburban Fairfax County. John Kester installed me in a small office outside his suite. From that vantage point, I watched him and was intrigued. Kester was a player. I soon observed that all significant Pentagon power lines ran through his hands. The Secretary, Harold Brown, made the final decisions, but Kester had so arranged it that nobody got to Secretary Brown without going through him first. Early in 1978, I went home to accompany my mother on a visit to Pop's doctor. The doctor went straight to the point. Pop had cancer of the liver. It was terminal. Maybe a year. Probably less. My mother took it hard, and not long after, the formative figure in my life was gone. John Kester served two masters, Secretary of Defense Brown and Brown's deputy secretary, the number two man in the Pentagon, Charles Duncan. Duncan's military assistant had recently been promoted to Major General and was in line for a division command. Duncan, however, was not going to let him go until he had a suitable replacement. The military assistant's job rated at least a brigadier general. One day in December 1978, as Charles Duncan was passing by my cubicle, he gave me a wink and a wave before disappearing into Kester's office. A minute later, John buzzed me to come in. I found both men wearing Cheshire cat grins. "Congratulations," John said. "You've made brigadier general." Before I had a chance to absorb the news, Duncan added, "And I want you to come to work as my military assistant." Promotion from lieutenant colonel to full colonel is a step up. From colonel to brigadier general is a huge leap. I did not take this promotion coolly. I acted more like a kid on Christmas morning. We brought my mother to Washington for the promotion ceremony. Aunts, uncles, and cousins also flooded to Burke Center. Our home turned into a madhouse. The one gaping hole was Pop. Still, I felt that he was out there somewhere, strutting among the other souls, saying, "Of course, what did you expect?" Charles Duncan and I became fast friends. We played racquetball almost every day, and we traveled the world together. One night, as I was getting ready to leave work, he asked me to stay a while. The Carter administration was in upheaval. "Colin," he began, "I'm leaving. The president wants me to take over the Department of Energy, and I want you to come with me." As I started to object, he raised his hand. It was all set. He had cleared the matter with the new Army Chief of Staff, General Edward Shy Meyer. Duncan promised that he would let me go as soon as he had his feet wet at DOE. Thankfully, after just 2.5 months, Duncan had as firm a grip as he was ever going to get over this bureaucratic jury rig. I had done my part and told him that I was eager to leave. Duncan was gracious about releasing me. My hopes for return to the Army were torpedoed. W. Graham Clater, Jr., previously Secretary of the Navy, had moved into Duncan's spot as the number two man at defense, and Clater asked me to become his military assistant. Thursday, April 24, 1980, was a clear, sunny day in Washington. As the morning wore on, I could feel tension mounting along the Eisenhower corridor. The next morning at 7 a.m., a knot of early birds gathered around a television set in the Deputy Secretary's office as President Carter, his face ashen, explained what had happened the day before. An attempt had been made to rescue 53 American hostages seized by Iranian students and held captive in the American embassy in Tehran for the past 5 months. The mission, the president said, had failed. And the failure may well have fatally wounded the Carter presidency. I continued working for Graham Clater for the next 8 months. I liked and admired all my Pentagon bosses, Kester, Duncan, and Clater. Consequently, I approached Election Day in 1980 with mixed feelings. The Carter administration had been mauled by double-digit inflation and the humiliating spectacle of the Americans held hostage in Iran. On the whole, the vibrations coming out of the Carter White House were not comforting to the military profession. Dropping the B-1 bomber was wise, but other force cuts were so damaging that the Army Chief of Staff, General Meyer, went before Congress complaining of a hollow army, thus handing the Reagan forces a potent campaign issue. Reagan was elected handily. At the Pentagon, we now waited for the other shoe to drop. Who would be the next Secretary of Defense? Finally, the other shoe fell, and a shudder went through the Pentagon. Caspar Weinberger, his reputation honed in the Nixon Department of Health, Education, and Welfare as Cap the Knife, was to be Secretary of Defense. Because Weinberger had once been Director of the Office of Management and Budget, and because I had served my White House fellowship there, I was dispatched one evening shortly before the inauguration to bring him to the Pentagon to look over his new office. He greeted me with a kind of Victorian cordiality and said he was delighted that we would be working together again. While honored, I wondered what those words might augur for my hopes of going back to the Army. That was what Alma wanted, too. She pointed out something of which I was unaware. I was much more relaxed, much more a man in his natural habitat, much more fun in straight military assignments. On his last day in the Pentagon, Clater held a small award ceremony. At the end, he shook my hand and said, "Colin, don't be surprised if you end up as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff someday." I remember thinking it was a nice compliment, but an unlikely prophecy. I was walking past the Secretary of Defense's office just after the inauguration when a familiar figure with the compact, wiry frame of a wrestler in which he had been stepped into the hallway. "Mr. Carlucci," I said, "welcome to the department." He was now waiting out Senate confirmation as Weinberger's number two at defense. "Mr. Secretary, let me know what I can do for you. For one thing, don't call me Mr. Secretary. Just call me Frank." Proof that a new era had dawned came as the new administration took over the defense budget. Ronald Reagan had run on a strong defense platform. Word went out from Weinberger's office asking the service chiefs how much more funding they needed. This was Christmas in February. I liked working with Carlucci, but by now I had been in the front office suites for nearly 4 years. "Frank," I said, "I want to go back to doing what brigadier generals are supposed to do." "Yeah, sure. We'll get around to it," he answered. By early spring, by constantly badgering Carlucci, I managed to pull it off. General Meyer assigned me as Assistant Division Commander for Operations and Training, 4th Infantry Division Mechanized, Fort Carson, Colorado. The ADC posting is an apprenticeship for command of a full division. I could not have chosen better myself. To my surprise, many whose judgment I valued did not share my enthusiasm, including Major General Dick Lawrence, under whom I had served in the AmeriCal Division in Vietnam, and General Julius Becton, who had steered me to the National War College. "Colin," Lawrence told me, "I would give anything not to see you going to Fort Carson." "Why?" I wanted to know. Lawrence said, "Because of the 4th Mex commander, Major General John W. Hudacek. He knew Hudacek, and the guy was, well, difficult." "He shouldn't have been given a division," Dick said. General Hudacek's leadership style was that of a tough overseer. The job got done, but by coercion, not motivation. Staff conferences turned into harangues. Inspections became inquisitions. The endless negative pressure exhausted the staff, including me. I started hearing complaints from fellow officers that we had a co-commander at Fort Carson. While General Hudacek rode herd and his subordinates, the Wise reported that Mrs. Hudacek did the same with them. I became the lightning rod for these grievances. Finally, I decided, yes, pay the king his shilling, and the queen too, if necessary, but the situation at Fort Carson had gone too far. I had been watching it for 4 months and saw morale sagging. I believed that I had a responsibility to act. Tom Blagg, the chief of staff, sat outside Hudacek's office and under his thumb. I told Tom that the division had serious problems, and I wanted to talk to Hudacek about how we might fix the situation. Colin, Tom said, don't do it. It's not a problem Hudacek can discuss or even admit. I'm warning you, you won't help him, and you might hurt yourself. Tom, I don't have any choice, I said. I would be neglecting my duty if I ducked this one. What is it? Hudacek asked as I came into his office. I went over a few diversionary training items, and then I started tiptoeing into the minefield. Sir, I think we could do more with the Wives. They are not as involved as they should be. The response was a blank stare. I pushed on. Your wife has wonderful ideas. She wants to do so much for the troops and their families. Still, a stony silence. I think we need to find a way to pursue her interests with a little more participation by the other wives. The conversation did not end or even develop. It just withered. I no sooner got in the door that night than Alma said, What did you do? Did I do something? Ann Hudacek called about an hour ago and asked me over for a cup of tea. Alma, she told me, I'm so sad. The general and I are really fond of you and Colin. We thought we could at least count on you two. By May 1982, I had completed my first year at Fort Carson. Hudacek called me into his office and handed me my annual efficiency report. My future hung on these pages. I went to bed that night with my head in a whirl. This was the worst professional judgment passed on me in 24 years in the Army. I slept poorly that night. The next morning, however, I went into the office and I felt fine. Just as I had learned on that hillside in Vietnam after witnessing my first death in battle, things always look better in the morning. I had blown it. Still, I had no regrets. I had done what I thought was right. I would live with the consequences. I went on enjoying my duties. One night I sat down at my desk at home and retooled my resume for the civilian market. I thought I would give the General Officer Management Office a call to make sure I was going to stay at Fort Carson for another year. I got in touch with a lieutenant colonel who said, Funny you should call. We were just about to get in touch with you. General Hudacek was leaving, I was informed, going off to Korea to be Chief of Staff of the 8th Army. Major General Ted Jenness was coming out from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to replace him. In August, I was going to be assigned to Fort Leavenworth to take over Jenness's job as Deputy Commanding General of an operation called CACTA, Combined Arms Combat Development Activity. I hung up the phone, suspended somewhere between hope and bewilderment. Jenness was a 2-star. The job he was vacating and that I was going to was a 2-star slot. Either the folks at the Pentagon had not seen my latest efficiency report, or I had been brought back from the dead. As I prepared to go to Fort Leavenworth, I was still not sure what Mother Army was up to, but I had done some poking around. Until you become a general, the promotion machinery is fairly formal. There are not that many generals, though, so an informal network operates at that level. In the end, it came down to the fact that the generals knew the officer being raided, and they knew the officer who had raided him. My future was not foreclosed. My new job at Leavenworth was vital to the Army, but would not sound particularly thrilling to laymen. A prime objective was to make sure the different training schools, infantry, armor, artillery, and air defense, for example, trained their forces to fight as a team rather than solo performers. I quickly found myself caught up in designing a lighter-equipped, smaller infantry division for faster battlefield mobility, particularly useful in third-world conflicts. One of the historic houses at Fort Leavenworth was 611 Scott, built in 1841. Generals William Tecumseh Sherman, Philip Sheridan, and George Armstrong Custer had all lived under this roof. 611 Scott is a 10,000-square-foot, gleaming white mini-mansion set above the Missouri River. The dining room easily seats 40. The grounds are beautifully landscaped, and a handsome gazebo rises on the front lawn. This was now our home. Alma finally had her mansion, and I, at long last, was redeemed in her eyes. One afternoon in September, I came home early. Colin Elmer said, "You need a haircut." I had not done that well at the post barbershop and managed to dredge up from my memory a shop in the black section of the town of Leavenworth that I had patronized 14 years before. I drove downtown, and there was the shop. Inside, faded pinups advertising ancient hair tonics covered the wall. The shop was empty except for a barber older than his posters. He put down his newspaper and waved me to a chair. "Welcome, General," he said, introducing himself as Old Sarge. He handed me a small, red-covered diary. "I'm going to ask you to sign my book when we're done," he said. The cover was stamped 1959. I started thumbing through it. There, in 1968, I found Colin Powell, Major, United States Army. I did not remember signing the book. "You don't remember me," Old Sarge said, "but I remember you." "What's your name again?" I asked. "Jalister Linton," he said. "10th Cavalry, Buffalo Soldiers." We got to talking about all the sites on the post named for fabled soldiers of the past. I asked Old Sarge if anything at Leavenworth commemorated the Buffalo Soldiers. "Well," Linton said, "there's 9th and 10th Cavalry Avenues." I had never heard of them. I became curious about the history of the Buffalo Soldiers. I started reading everything I could lay my hands on. What I learned filled me with pride at the feats these black men had achieved, and with sadness at the injustices and neglect they had suffered. Not long after my visit to the barber shop, I was jogging past the post cemetery and came upon an abandoned trailer park. There I saw a leaning, weather-beaten street sign marking 9th Cavalry Avenue and another marking 10th Cavalry Avenue. I was still upset when I got to my office, and I called in the post historian. "Is that the best we can do? Two dirt roads in an abandoned trailer park?" "Sir, you're right. But before you blow a gasket, you should know what I went through just to get the Buffalo Soldiers even that recognition." I believed I had a duty to those black troops who had eased my way. Building a memorial to the Buffalo Soldiers became my personal crusade. In the spring of 1983, Secretary of Defense Weinberger wanted me to come to Washington for a chat. A few days later, I was walking down the familiar E-ring to the Secretary's office. As I entered, Weinberger rose and shook my hand warmly and told me he wanted me to be his military assistant. Now I had to go back and tell Alma that after less than a year, it was goodbye to Fort Leavenworth and the beloved House of History. I particularly regretted leaving the Buffalo Soldiers project unfinished. I had a black civilian on my staff, Alonzo Dougherty, who I trusted implicitly. "I'm turning it over to you," I told him. "I am counting on you to keep it alive." And Dougherty agreed to carry on. On one of the last days of my CACTA tour, Lieutenant General Carl Vono pinned a second star on me. The promotion to Major General was welcome enough professionally. Emotionally, it meant that I was finally out of purgatory. I had taken a gut wound with the Fort Carson efficiency report and had survived. It would not be wise, however, to run that risk again. I had received an early education in the style of my new boss on one of my first days on the job. I had arrived early at about 6:30 a.m. and was flipping through the Early Bird, the Pentagon's overnight news summary, when an item plucked from the Washington Post caught my eye. The Navy had established a wound laboratory to train medical students in the treatment of battlefield injuries. They were going to practice on dogs that had been anesthetized, then shot. Alarm bells started going off in my head. I had visions of Americans learning that Lassie or Snoopy had been sacrificed to military medical experimentation. I called my counterpart in the Secretary of the Navy's office. Secretary Weinberger was going to want to know what this was all about. "I'll get you something later in the morning," he said. I told him he'd better give me something now. The secretary was due any minute. A vote on the placement of MX missiles was the hot issue this morning, and the secretary had scheduled early interviews with all three networks. I had barely hung up when Weinberger came through the door. His first words were, "What's this about shooting little dogs?" "Sir," I started to explain. "Put a stop to it," he said. "Sir, this kind of medical research is helping. Tell the Navy it's over. The program is canceled. They are not even to consider it. Is that clear?" I transmitted the order. The world could have been on the brink of nuclear extinction, but Bryant Gumbel's first question was about the Washington Post dog story. "No such thing could happen," Weinberger answered coolly. He had already given orders canceling any such program, if indeed one ever existed. His other interviews led off with the same question. Weinberger's reaction that day had been intuitive. He had not called for a blue-ribbon panel of surgeons, psychiatrists, veterinarians, and people for ethical treatment of animals to masticate the issue. He had recognized instantly in a nation of pet lovers that whatever the scientific premise, this idea would not fly, and so he killed it on the spot. Phone calls and letters poured in. Weinberger was a hero. I had learned a lesson from a master in public relations. Certain matters are sacrosanct. Also, you can face the messiest public issue, and if you tackle it head-on and quickly, you can move a debit to the asset column. In October 1983, we learned that Judge William Clark, President Reagan's current national security advisor, was stepping down. Clark's deputy, a former Marine lieutenant colonel now in his mid-40s, Robert C. Bud McFarlane, would replace Judge Clark. McFarlane's most visible subordinate turned out to be a brash Marine, Ollie North, a lieutenant colonel. North was fast becoming a legend, the guy you went to get things done. North displayed remarkable imagination and energy, but every now and then strange things happened. One day one of my assistants came to my office and said, "General, Colonel North wants a permit to carry a gun." "Why does he need a gun around the National Security Council?" I wanted to know. "People are out to get him," my assistant said. "Who?" He didn't say. Ollie North's personal security had nothing to do with the Secretary of Defense. I told my assistant to let the Navy figure it out. On October 23rd, I received a middle-of-the-night call from the National Military Command Center. A terrorist truck bomb had struck U.S. Marine headquarters at the airport in Beirut, Lebanon. Our Marines had been stationed in Lebanon for the fuzzy idea of providing a presence. The year before, the Israelis had invaded Lebanon in one final push to drive out PLO terrorists. This move had upset the always precarious Middle East balance. The United States, consequently, was attempting to referee the withdrawal of all foreign troops from Lebanon. The Marines had been deployed around the Beirut airport as what State Department euphemists called an interpositional force. Translation? The Marines were to remain between two powder kegs, the Lebanese army and the Syrian-backed Shiite units fighting it out in the Shuf Mountains. Weinberger had opposed the Marines' involvement from the start, but lost the policy debate in the White House to McFarland and to Secretary of State George Shultz. On August 29th, before the airport truck bombing, two Marines had been killed by Muslim mortar fire. On September 3rd, two more, and on October 16th, two more. Against Weinberger's protest, McFarland, now in Beirut, persuaded the president to have the battleship USS New Jersey start hurling 16-inch shells into the Shuf Mountains. What we tend to overlook in such situations is that other people will react much as we would. When the shells started falling on the Shiites, they assumed the American referee had taken sides against them, and since they could not reach the battleship, they found a more vulnerable target, the exposed Marines at the airport. What I saw from my perch in the Pentagon was America sticking its hand into a thousand-year-old hornet's nest with the expectation that our mere presence might pacify the hornets. When ancient ethnic hatreds reignited in the former Yugoslavia in 1991, and well-meaning Americans thought we should do something in Bosnia, the shattered bodies of Marines at the Beirut airport were never far from my mind in arguing for caution. The Beirut bombing was soon followed by our invasion of Grenada on October 25th. The Caribbean island had fallen under the control of a young Marxist, Maurice Bishop, whose regime was building a jet runway with Cuban aid. The strip was going to be made available to the Soviet Union. Then, Bishop was assassinated, and the chaos following his murder threatened nearly 1,000 American medical students studying on Grenada. We attacked with a combined force of Army paratroopers, Marines, and Navy SEALs. It should have been easy enough to take over a country defended by a Third World militia of about 2,000 poorly armed troops and a Cuban construction battalion. Yet it took most of a week to subdue all resistance and rescue the medical students. The invasion was hardly a model joint operation. Relations between the services were marred by poor communications, fractured command and control, inter-service parochialism, and micromanagement from Washington. I was only a fly on the wall at the time, but I filed away the lessons learned. My father had already passed away, and so had Alma's mother in 1972. As we entered 1984, Alma was about to lose her father, and I my mother. My father had been the formative figure in my life. The role of my mother was different, but scarcely less important. From her I absorbed the lifelong habit of work and self-discipline. I never understood how she could work so hard away from home every day, yet never allow my sister or me to feel anything but mothered. Parents are the luck of the draw. In my father and mother, I could not have been luckier. In May 1985, I was invited to speak at the ROTC commissioning ceremony at the College of William and Mary. Among the cadets I was to commission this day was Michael Powell. In the audience beside Alma were Mike's sisters, Linda, a William and Mary sophomore, and Anne Marie, soon to be a freshman there. I like to think that Thomas Jefferson, an uneasy slaveholder, would have appreciated the Powells getting a first-rate education at the college from which he graduated. A large part of my day in the Weinberger office involved going through correspondence addressed to him to decide what required his personal attention. The document dated June 17, 1985, was a stunner, a draft National Security Decision Directive, an NSDD, entitled U.S. Policy Toward Iran, printed on White House letterhead, addressed to Weinberger and Secretary of State George Shultz, and classified top secret. As I read through the NSDD, I realized what it represented. Bud McFarlane, the current National Security Advisor, was making a bid for Kissingerian immortality. Kissinger, former holder of the job, had demonstrated along with President Nixon the conceptual audacity to think the unthinkable, to open a door to communist China that America had kept shut for a generation. And what could be more unthinkable than to propose sending U.S. arms to the Iranian government of the Ayatollah Khomeini, a regime that had held 52 American hostages for over a year, that the United States had formally declared a terrorist state, that the president had said the United States would never deal with, and that was linked to the bombing deaths of 241 Marines in Beirut? Could anything be more audacious? I shot this document into the secretary. I was eager to hear Weinberger's reaction. When the memo came back, I felt proud of my boss. Across the cover memo, Weinberger had written, "This is almost too absurd to comment on. It's like asking Gaddafi to Washington for a cozy chat," referring to Libya's strongman. Normally, Weinberger found Bud McFarlane about as communicative as a stone. But after this dismissal of his brainstorm, McFarlane argued that this bold initiative could win over Iranian moderates. "The only moderates in Iran," Weinberger answered, "are in the cemetery. It was foolish to expect good faith in obtaining the release of hostages from the same regime that had countenanced their seizure." It was Weinberger's habit to keep a record on little white pads of what was happening during his day. The notes ranged from entries like "McFarlane meeting on NSDD" to "call the vet." As he completed a pad, he put it into the middle right-hand drawer of his desk. Did this small mountain of notes constitute a diary? As a result of McFarlane's arms for hostage plan and the subsequent Iran-Contra scandal, the question would one day have legal implications for Caspar Weinberger and for me. Every morning I received a black plastic case stamped top secret, containing the choicest intelligence winging around the world and intercepted by our electronic eavesdropping enterprise, the National Security Agency. Vice Admiral Arthur Moreau, the assistant to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, came to me one morning with an odd revelation. The secretary's office was not getting some of the most curious traffic that NSA plucked out of the air. On his own hook, Art had decided to share this withheld material with me. What I read amazed me. Foreign intermediaries were, for a price, evidently cooking up arms deals between Reagan administration officials and the alleged Iranian moderates. McFarlane's initiative evidently was very much alive. I started showing the intercepts to Weinberger. Each time he called McFarlane, trying to find out what was going on, the National Security Advisor remained closed-mouthed. Weinberger continued to rail against the Iranian arms deal, which appeared to have attracted the sleaziest sort of rug merchants. Still, loyalty to the president remained CAP's code. Late in December, Bud McFarlane decided to resign as National Security Advisor. We were hardly encouraged by the news of his successor, Admiral John Poindexter, McFarlane's deputy. On January 17, 1986, the president signed a top-secret finding of necessity declaring that the covert sale of arms to Iran was in our country's interest. The scheme was still foolhardy, but now legal. Illegality in what came to be known as the Iran-Contra affair grew out of other elements, namely the diversion of funds to the Nicaraguan Contras and perjured testimony given by participants before Congress. The day after the president signed the finding, Weinberger was told to start implementing it. He directed me to arrange for the transfer to the CIA of 4,000 TOW missiles, an anti-tank weapon. The TOWs were to go to the CIA under a federal law which allowed government agencies to transfer material to each other. This stratagem was legal as far as the Army was concerned. The TOWs were then to be transferred by the CIA to Iran. We treated the TOW transfer like garbage to be gotten out of the house quickly. Soon after delivery of the first batch of TOWs, I got a call from a worried Lieutenant General Arthur Brown, director of the Army staff. "We don't know where this stuff is going," Brown said, "but it sure as hell isn't staying with the CIA. The Army General Council has advised us that you should be aware that if arms in that amount are going to a foreign country, Congress has to be notified." "Put all that in a memo," I told Brown. On getting his memo, I drafted a memo of my own to Admiral John Poindexter, repeating the legal requirement that Congress must be notified. I handed the memo to Poindexter personally at the weekly breakfast meeting the NSC chief held with Weinberger and George Shultz. What we did not know was that Poindexter and company did plan to notify Congress in the last week of the Reagan administration, 3 years off. Timely congressional notification might have blown this scheme out of the water. Most of my tasks and 1,001 phone calls would evaporate with time, but I did leave one mark. The Secretary of Defense's office is located in the Eisenhower Corridor of the Pentagon. The corridors in Army, Navy, and Air Force country were decorated like mini-museums, while the Eisenhower Corridor was hung with a few pictures. Ike's Hall, I believed, should honor his memory more dramatically. Weinberger, a lover of history and tradition, concurred. 9 months after the work first began, John D. Eisenhower, the late president's son, presided over the dedication of the refurbished corridor. Among the glass display cases were mementos of the military career of the Allied leader who gave the fateful go for the invasion of Normandy. The corridor today is an attraction on the Pentagon tour and a lasting source of pride to me. On March 26, 1986, Cap Weinberger personally presented me with the third star that went with my new job as a corps commander. I was off to command 5th Corps in Germany. The assignment stirred powerful emotions in me. I was returning to the place where I had begun my military career commanding 40 troops. I was now to command 75,000. In one sense, not much had changed in the quarter century since my last West German tour. My present mission was to be prepared to engage Soviet forces the instant they advanced across that weave of valleys forming the Fulda Gap, the same role I had had as a young lieutenant. I found it deeply satisfying to see how the budget victories won by the Pentagon were being translated into tangible improvements in Germany. Thanks to the Reagan-Weinberger buildup, modern equipment rolled into the Corps, and the troops' quarters became more livable. By now, the all-volunteer army was fully in place, and we were getting the best-educated enlistees in history. Our house resembled a checkpoint at a hostile border crossing, but despite living in a semi-fortress, we were happy in Frankfurt. The workday usually ended at 5. The phone was not constantly ringing in the middle of the night with the deputy director of operations reporting the latest international firestorm. By comparative standards, I had jumped from the frying pan into the easy chair. Though we were in the same country, we did not see much of Mike. Most of our contact was via letters, and Mike's news took me back to my own days as a young officer. He, too, wanted to make the Army his life. It pleased me that he had reached this decision on his own. While I was immersed in running 5th Corps in Germany, those clandestine NSA messages I had brought to Weinberger's attention in Washington finally uncoiled spectacularly in the Iran-Contra affair. In November, the world learned that the United States had been secretly selling arms to Khomeini's regime, despite President Reagan's pledge never to deal with terrorists. Then came the next shocker, revealed by Attorney General Edward Meese. The Poindexter North operation had jacked up the prices of weapons sold to Iran and siphoned off the profits into private bank accounts to help fund the Nicaraguan Contras. I had not known of this diversion, nor had the President, the Cabinet, or Congress. Poindexter resigned, and President Reagan dismissed Ollie North. The President now had to appoint a new national security advisor, and I heard that Frank Carlucci was the leading candidate. When Frank called, I congratulated him, but his first words made my heart sink. "Colin, you've got to come back. I've taken over a mess, and I need you to help me clean it up. I want you to be my deputy. We need you, Colin. This is serious. Believe me, the presidency is at stake." "Frank, you're going to ruin my career," I told him. "We'll talk again," he said, and hung up. 2 days later, Carlucci called again. "There is only one way I can make this departure honorable, the only way I'll be able to face my fellow officers," I said. "It can't come from you, Frank. It has to be a request directly from the commander-in-chief. That's the one thing my world will understand." "Okay." 2 days passed, and nothing happened. I dared hope that I had dodged the bullet. Alma and I had just come home from a Christmas party and were sitting in the kitchen when the phone rang. I picked it up. I heard the commanding voice of a White House operator. The President was calling. On January 2, 1987, I found myself sitting in the west wing of the White House in a cubicle about the size of the bathroom in my Fifth Corps office. In February, the Tower Commission released its report on the Iran-Contra affair. It depicted President Reagan as confused and uninformed, and found that his hands-off management style was the reason he did not know what was going on in his own presidency. The Tower report became our owner's manual. We did what it recommended. Carlucci issued an order that the NSC was not to become involved in clandestine operations. The Tower Commission had come down hard on Cap Weinberger and George Shultz for not being aggressive enough in finding out what Poindexter's NSC was up to. This was an unfair rap, and I knew that Weinberger, as well as the rest of us at Defense, had no knowledge of the most illegal aspect of the affair, the diversion of Iranian arms sales profits to the Contras. Three issues dominated the National Security Council. First was the changed East-West dynamic created by Mikhail Gorbachev. Next was the muddle in Central America, made even muddier by the Iran-Contra revelations. And finally, there was the Middle East, where Iran and Iraq were still warring and endangering the free flow of oil through the Persian Gulf, and where American hostages were still held captive in hiding places in Lebanon, despite the arms given to Iran. To perform our NSC role, we had to add to the alphabet soup. Since the NSC was responsible for pulling together positions from several departments and agencies for the President's consideration, we needed a coordinating body and created the PRG, the Policy Review Group. Just 10 days after my arrival, the Persian Gulf became the PRG's first order of business. All departments were informed that henceforth only one channel of communication existed between the United States and Iran, the State Department. We also made clear that Iran would not get so much as a slingshot from America while the arms embargo lasted. And since the free flow of oil from the Persian Gulf was as crucial to us as blood pumping through an artery, Iraqi and Iranian threats to Kuwaiti oil tankers would be met. We advised the Kuwaiti government that the United States was willing to respond to its request to put its tankers under U.S. flags, thus placing the vessels under America's protection. What we were trying to create, which had not existed before, was policy that everybody understood and agreed on. Carlucci and I wanted clear positions that the cabinet helped shape, that the president blessed, and that the Congress understood. The next big question was what to do about the Contras, who were still fighting the Marxist Sandinista government in Nicaragua. I became the chief administration advocate, trying to win enough congressional support to keep the Contras afloat. Overarching all other concerns was our relationship with the Soviet Union. While we were tackling global issues at the NSC, the country's attention was riveted to the joint congressional hearing on the Iran-Contra affair. I was not called to testify by the Congressional Investigating Committee, but I did give a deposition to committee lawyers concerning my role in helping arrange the transfer of TOWS to the CIA. I met in the White House with Arthur Lyman, chief Senate counsel. Offhandedly, Lyman said, "Maybe I should know this, but did the secretary keep a diary?" "The secretary, to my knowledge, did not keep a diary," I answered. I had never seen anything that would meet the common understanding of a diary. But I alluded to notes, because I remembered the little white pads Cap kept in his desk drawer. The notes were not a secret. They were subsequently placed in the Library of Congress, and not destroyed or spirited away. In 1991, 4 years after my first interview, the Independent Counsel staff reviewed the pads at the Library of Congress. The staff questioned me at length on entries in the pads, which I was now permitted to read for the first time. Weinberger's lawyer, Bob Bennett, then asked me to give a deposition on the matter. In that deposition, I made one casual reference to the notepads as a diary.